You're listening to the free ad-sponsored re-release of American Election's Wicked Game, a weekly march through every presidential election from 1789 to 2024. To listen to all episodes right now ad-free, go to intohistory.com. Subscribers there enjoy ad-free listening, early access, bonus content, and more from a growing collection of great history podcasts. Start your free trial today at intohistory.com. It's early June 1908 at President Teddy Roosevelt's office in the White House. War Secretary William Howard Taft waits impatiently for the president to arrive. Teddy's personal aide, Captain Archie Butt, does his best to entertain the president's guest.
Mr. Secretary, may I offer you anything?
No.
Impatient, Taft's eyes dart over to the clock on the wall. It's just before 9:30 a.m. Taft fidgets in his seat, clearly distressed. Archie knows why Taft's upset. He recently bungled a speech at the tomb of Civil War general and previous president Ulysses S. Grant. In the speech, he made a reference to Grant's struggles with alcohol. Taft was trying to use Grant's issues with sobriety as an example of a man overcoming his personal demons, but the press lambasted Taft for his clumsy remarks. Now he's worried his misstep is going to cost him in the upcoming presidential election of 1908. Archie, though, does his best to calm Taft's nerves.
Mr. Secretary, I'm sure the president will be here any moment.
Well, I'm not holding my breath.
It's clear Taft is in a mood, but Archie's more concerned with the disposition of his boss. Just yesterday, Teddy experienced a public bungle of his own. While on a leisurely ride with his wife, Teddy was bucked off his horse. There were plenty of eyewitnesses, and of course, they immediately went to the press. So Teddy is likely to be in a sour mood today, even more sour than his war secretary. Just then, as the clock strikes 9:30, Teddy bursts into his office. Before anyone can say a word, the president strikes a mock military pose and cries out in a booming voice, "Viva Grant!" Archie is shocked to find his boss in a jovial mood. As Teddy chuckles at his own joke, Taft stands to greet him with a long face.
"Mr. President, I..."
"Don't worry, Taft. This whole Grant business is not going to hurt you." "Well, I wish I shared your confidence."
Teddy suddenly turns his attention to Archie. He adopts a serious tone.
"Yes, yes. Before we get into all that, should like Captain Butt to get me another horse."
Well, forgive me, Mr. President. I rode that horse myself, the one that bucked you, and all seemed well."
"All seemed well, huh? Well, I don't mind so much being dumped out of my saddle, but my wife is a concerned patriot. Mrs. Roosevelt has made me promise not to get killed till after the 4th of March, upon which date I can die all I want."
Teddy cracks a broad grin. Archie chuckles. Taft forces a smile.
"Well, Mr. President, if you do ride any fractious horses, I wish you would take Mr. Fairbanks with you."
That's Charles Fairbanks, a pro-Wall Street Republican and Taft's presumptive vice presidential running mate. The smile fades from Teddy's face as he tries to comfort his friend.
No need to do away with Mr. Fairbanks. He'll make Wall Street happy. Besides, if I were to ride something out of Washington, I'd start with the United States Senate."
This time, even Taft chuckles. Teddy leans in close to offer his war secretary reassurance.
"Trust me, friend. I've got the American public accustomed to hearing the truth, or at least my version of it. The truth is this. Come November, this office will be yours."
The matter settled, Teddy turns back to Archie.
"And as far as I'm concerned, Captain, it's worth it losing one's horse to find out one's friends. For only a friend would lend another man his razor or his horse. What's your horse's name again?"
"My horse? Larry."
"Larry, of course. I believe he'll do just fine."
Archie gladly lent the president his personal horse. Teddy told Archie that Larry was as good an animal as he had ever ridden, and Teddy was confident in another horse, too. His hand-picked successor for president, William Howard Taft. Taft won the 1908 race handily, in large part thanks to Teddy's popularity and his endorsement. After Taft's victory, Teddy hoped to leave Washington to spend his first days of freedom pursuing one of his greatest passions, the outdoors. He planned to take a back seat while President Taft worked to fulfill his progressive legacy. But soon after the 1908 contest, Taft went his own way. He largely abandoned Teddy's vision for America. And just a few years into the Taft administration, Teddy was beginning to worry he had bet on the wrong horse.
Wicked Game is sponsored by NetSuite. There's that saying, that's just the cost of doing business, and it makes it sound like there's nothing you can do about certain expenses. And yeah, sure, if you run a business, there are certain things that are just going to cost what they cost, and recently they've probably begun costing more. But not everything is just the cost of doing business. Smart companies know their numbers and can reduce their costs. One great way of doing both is switching to NetSuite, the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. And with NetSuite, you'll reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessible from anywhere. You'll cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite, and you improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math and see how you'll profit with NetSuite this year. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/elections. That's netsuite.com/elections, netsuite.com/elections. Wicked Game is sponsored by BetterHelp. I need to get something off my chest. Think about that phrase. Visualize it. The metaphor is that something is literally on your chest, weighing you down, pressing down upon you, that when you lay in bed at night, there's a heavy burden bearing down on you. And everyone has these weights, deep concerns, feelings of guilt, anger, or misery we try to keep to ourselves. But therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever's weighing you down. And as the world's largest therapy service, BetterHelp has matched 3 million people with professionally licensed and vetted therapists available 100% online. Plus, it's affordable. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to match with a therapist. And if things aren't clicking, you can easily switch to a new therapist anytime. No waiting rooms, no traffic. It couldn't be simpler. So get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/elections today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/elections. From Airship, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is American Elections Wicked Game. Theodore Roosevelt had another nickname, one he much preferred to Teddy, the Colonel. He earned the name during his heroic service in the Spanish-American War. In 1910, as the Colonel enjoyed a months-long African safari, his successor, President William Howard Taft, tried in vain to fill Roosevelt's shoes in the White House. As Taft struggled to run the country, he angered progressive Republicans who championed corporate regulations and environmental conservation. Taft's more conservative approach did more than just alienate progressives, but stirred the ire of the very man who had anointed him. And as Taft moved more to the right, Republicans further divided into two factions, the conservatives lining up behind Taft, and the progressives beginning to call for the return of the Colonel. In the midst of this turmoil, Woodrow Wilson, a Democrat who grew up in Virginia and a political newcomer, quickly learned to play the game, gaining power, prestige, and national name recognition. While Wilson planned his political insurgency from the New Jersey governor's seat, both Democrats and Republicans alike found themselves struggling to hold their progressive and conservative factions together. With the presidential election of 1912 looming on the horizon, the Colonel would return to the political fold and make the 1912 contest a three-way race between three presidents, one past, one present, and one future. This is episode 32, 1912, Wilson versus Taft versus Roosevelt, the Bull Moose. In June 1908, William Howard Taft and President Roosevelt had been close friends and political allies for years. Taft had served as Roosevelt's Secretary of War from 1904 to the summer of 1908, when Taft turned his attention to the upcoming presidential contest. In those 4 years, the two men had worked hard to push Roosevelt's progressive platform. 4 years prior, at the beginning of his term in 1904, Roosevelt had pledged, "The wise custom which limits the president to two terms regards the substance and the form, and under no circumstance will I be a candidate for or accept another nomination."
In 1908, Roosevelt kept his promise. He stepped aside as a presidential hopeful and endorsed William Howard Taft. Roosevelt hoped that Taft's presidency would be a seamless continuation of his own administration, but it wouldn't. As president, Taft soon established his own identity and his own agenda by appointing an almost entirely new cabinet. This decision led to a political scandal that would cloud Taft's entire presidency. Centered around Taft's choice for Secretary of the Interior, a man named Richard Ballinger. A lawyer from Seattle, Washington, Ballinger had worked in D.C. for years as head of the land office. Many of his colleagues said that he had a reputation for ability, industry, and fairness. Taft respected Ballinger as an independent thinker and ardent conservationist. Further, as a politician from the West Coast, Taft hoped Ballinger would bring geographical balance to his cabinet. With this goal in mind, Taft unceremoniously and suddenly fired the current Secretary of the Interior and replaced him with Ballinger. Failing to consider the larger political picture, Taft explained, "I have my own record to make, my own place to secure, and the confidence of the country." Roosevelt felt disappointed and a little betrayed, but he supported Taft in public, stating, "Taft's system may be different, but the results will be the same." But Ballinger would prove the colonel wrong. In 1909, Ballinger discovered what he considered an illegal action that occurred during Roosevelt's previous administration. Without congressional approval, Roosevelt and the chief of U.S. Forestry, Gifford Pinchot, had taken millions of acres of land into government control. They had hoped to protect these areas from monopolistic companies seeking to exploit the land for energy. But Ballinger viewed this move as an illegal overstep. As Secretary of the Interior, Ballinger still wanted to protect the land. And to do so, he restored the lands to the public domain. Ballinger planned to survey the areas to find which ones needed government protection, then take those acres into government control through more legal channels. Taft backed Ballinger's actions. He, like Ballinger, wanted to conserve the environment, but only on the basis of law. Pinchot and most progressive Republicans disagreed with Ballinger's actions. Progressives feared that much of the land could be purchased by corporations in the time it took to complete surveys and get congressional approval for government annexation of the areas. With Roosevelt in Africa, only Chief Forester Gifford Pinchot remained in Washington, D.C. to fight Ballinger's move, and Pinchot chose a very public forum to take his stand. On August 9, 1909, Ballinger and Pinchot attended a conservationist conference in Spokane, Washington. That day, a big story hit the newsstands. It claimed that private companies had purchased almost 16,000 acres of the federally held lands that Ballinger had released. The companies, the story said, were now exploiting that acreage for profit. The article contained one critical error, though. It was not 15,868 acres. It was 158.68 acres. A decimal point had been dropped, making the purchase seem 10 times larger than it was. But in spite of the massive error, the damage was done, and Pinchot sought to use the mistake to his advantage. The next day, Pinchot gave a speech attacking Ballinger and defending conservation. He declared, "The purpose of the conservation movement is to make our country a permanent and prosperous home for ourselves and our children." Pinchot went on to argue that Ballinger's strict construction of the law turned this fight into a struggle between the interests of the few versus the good of the many. After hearing the speech, conference attendees burst into applause for Pinchot, and the cheering lasted for 5 full minutes. Ballinger lost in the court of public opinion before he even had a chance to put his own plan into action, but President Taft believed Ballinger to be in the right and issued a statement defending his Secretary of the Interior. As for Pinchot's fate, Taft could have fired him immediately, but he didn't. Instead, Taft made a more politically astute decision. The president sent a letter to Pinchot praising his work and asking him to stay on as Chief of U.S. Forestry. "My dear Gifford," Taft wrote, "I have the utmost confidence in your conscientious desire to serve the government and the public. I should consider it one of the greatest losses that my administration could sustain if you were to leave it." But Taft was not being generous. He was looking for a political win. Keeping Pinchot on his staff might have quieted criticisms among the public that Taft did not care about the conservation movement. But these attempts by Taft did not defuse the situation. The two men and their supporters continued to fight publicly. Pinchot unearthed dirt on Ballinger, showing that the former lawyer had favored a special interest group in a shady Alaskan coal mine deal. The claim was not baseless, and as a result, Congress decided to open an investigation into Ballinger's purported misdeeds. Pinchot saw this as a decisive success, but he was just getting started. On January 5, 1910, Pinchot bypassed his boss, Agriculture Secretary James Wilson, and the president by sending a damaging report on Ballinger directly to Congress. Taft deemed this move a piece of insubordination almost unparalleled in the history of government, but Taft still hesitated to act. He worried that firing Pinchot would end his already strained relationship with Roosevelt and weaken his re-election prospects. Taft agonized over the decision and asked several people to weigh in. One advisor looked at the facts and stated, "There is only one thing for you to do now, and that you must do at once." So that night, Taft fired Gifford Pinchot. The embattled president explained, "The people place me in an office of the highest dignity and proper respect for the office on the part of my subordinates. By your own conduct, you have destroyed your usefulness as a helpful subordinate." Taft hoped this would be the end of the Ballinger-Pinchot affair, but the scandal was just beginning. The consequences of Taft's actions would reverberate all the way up to the 1912 election. It would further divide the Republican Party, and it would turn friend into foe. It's January 17, 1910, in the Congo. The colonel is on an extended African safari, hunting big game with his 21-year-old son, Kermit. The Roosevelts have been exploring, camping, and hunting for nearly a year on this expedition, sponsored by the Smithsonian Institute to gather specimens for its new natural history museum. Today, the colonel and his son and their African guides plod through the grasslands in search of a rhino herd.
"Ugh, it's damn hot out here. We should have gotten an earlier start."
Kermit agrees, and he lets his dad know as much.
"Ugh, sun's so hot, it's baking the mud into brick. It's hard to tell if these footprints are fresh, and I can't see how we're going to find anything in this tall grass. Let's fan out a bit."
Kermit and his gun-bearer, Cassitura, head to the right while the colonel and the rest of the party continue on. The hunters search for fresh rhinoceros prints as they slowly and silently move through the tall grass. Suddenly, Kermit calls out,
"Back here! Father, over here!"
Colonel quickly runs to join Kermit and Cassitura. He looks where his son is excitedly pointing and sees rhinoceros tracks.
"Ah, well done, boys. Those are fresh footprints, to be sure. I must have passed right over them. All right, let's move."
The group follows the prints for nearly an hour, with two Africans acting as trackers and guides. The colonel and Kermit follow closely behind. Suddenly, the guide holds up his hand and calls them to stop. He points to a tree about 60 yards in front of him. The colonel mounts a giant anthill to get a better vantage point. He and Kermit peer through the tall grass. They can just barely make out a large rhino near the foot of the tree.
"Oh, I see her, Father. Yeah, what a beauty."
But at the sound of the hunters' voices, the rhino sits up on its front legs. It's alert for danger. The colonel lifts his hunting rifle to his shoulder, takes aim, and pulls the trigger. The rhino falls to the earth with a loud thud. Nearby rhinos scatter at the sound of the shot. Kermit shoots a bull as it runs away.
"Oh, good shot, son. A fine day's work. Yes, yes."
It's all smiles in the group, and the colonel and his son return to camp while the other hunters prepare the specimens for the museum. But as the Roosevelts come in sight of their tent, a runner catches up to them, out of breath, and hands the colonel a letter. The former president opens it immediately. As he reads, his smile falls from his face. He looks grim now, shakes his head in frustration.
"What's the news, Father?"
"This letter is from Gifford Pinchot. He's just been dismissed as the chief of the U.S. Forest Service."
"Taft fired him?"
"It seems so."
"What does that mean?"
The colonel pauses for a moment to gather his thoughts.
It would be a very ungracious thing for an ex-president to criticize his successor. And I fear Mr. Taft has left me no choice."
After leaving the White House, the colonel left Washington behind, confident that his friend Taft would carry forward the torch of progressivism. But when Taft fired Gifford Pinchot in 1910, the colonel began to doubt that he could afford to stay out of politics. In the summer of 1910, the colonel left behind the hunt of the African wild for a political hunt in Washington. When Roosevelt returned from Africa in June of 1910, he received a hero's welcome. The fanfare and praise in the press only strengthened his resolve to seize the reins of the GOP from William Howard Taft. Roosevelt sought to bring unity back to the party, but as progressive Republicans lined up behind him, the rift inside the party only widened. That summer, the colonel went on a speaking tour and outlined his vision for the party and the country. His platform, called New Nationalism, went well beyond the progressive platforms he had previously championed. The former president advocated for a new, expanded role of government in the lives of Americans. He said, "I stand for fair play under the present rules of the game, but I stand for having those rules changed so as to work for a more substantial equity of opportunity." This new nationalist regards the executive power as the steward of the public welfare. Many progressive Republicans liked what Roosevelt was saying, but it put off many conservative Republicans. So as the 1910 midterm elections approached, Republican Party unity was crumbling. But as conservative Republicans fretted over the colonel's progressivism, conservative Democrats were worried about a similar rift in their party. In the 1908 presidential contest, Democratic nominee William Jennings Bryan had run a significant, albeit failed, campaign centered around populist policies. Bryan's successful nomination had been a clear sign to conservative Democrats that their base was turning more and more towards progressivism, a movement conservative party leaders were not quick to embrace. In the 1910 midterms, many concerned Democrats had their eye on the New Jersey governor's race and the presumptive Democratic nominee there, Woodrow Wilson. Wilson was president of Princeton University. As a young man, he had largely spoken in favor of conservative Democratic policies. But as the years went on, and as he rose to prominence in the Garden State, Wilson's rhetoric had taken on a more progressive, populist tone. This gradual yet subtle shift left many Democrats asking the question, what did Woodrow Wilson truly believe? In the summer of 1910, Democrat Party bosses were determined to hear the answer straight from the horse's mouth. So they sat down face to face with Woodrow Wilson in New York. Wilson told the party bosses what they wanted to hear, but once in power, Woodrow Wilson would abandon his conservative past. He would wear the label of progressivism like a badge of honor, and he would lead the traditionally conservative Democratic Party in a bold new direction. Did you know you can skip ads and promos like these and listen to all episodes of American Election's Wicked Game without interruption by subscribing at IntoHistory.com? And not only will you be getting the whole series ad-free and bingeable, but you also get access to over a dozen more incredible history podcasts, also all ad-free, like Wild West Extravaganza, a journey back to the fascinating, tumultuous, and often violent world of the American Old West. From famous outlaws like Billy the Kid and Jesse James, to lawmen like Wyatt Earp and Wild Bill Hickok, to trailblazing pioneers and frontiersmen, Wild West Extravaganza tells the true stories of the real-life characters who shaped this iconic era. So saddle up and discover the true history of the American frontier, the good, the bad, and the ugly, ad-free at IntoHistory.com. Did you know you can skip ads and promos like these and listen to all episodes of American Election's Wicked Game without interruption by subscribing at IntoHistory.com? And not only will you be getting the whole series ad-free and bingeable, but you also get access to over a dozen more incredible history podcasts, also ad-free, like Her Half of History. Because even though Hillary Clinton may not have made history when she ran for president in 2016, there have always been women who seized power, spied for their country, created artistic masterpieces, even escaped slavery. Her Half of History is perfect for all those who sat in history class and wondered, what were the women doing all this time? Because the answer is a lot. Get Her Half of History, Wicked Game, and many others ad-free at IntoHistory.com. Subscribe now at IntoHistory.com. It's summer 1910 in New York. A handful of Democratic power brokers are gathered at the Lawyers Club, a private meeting house in the city. These men are all guests of one of the most influential figures in American politics, Democratic kingmaker George Harvey, a powerful newspaper editor and railway magnate. Harvey sits at one end of a long table, surrounded by his colleagues. At the other end is Woodrow Wilson, the president of Princeton University. Harvey skips the pleasantries and gets right down to business.
Mr. Wilson, you know why we've asked you here today, I presume.
Of course, Mr. Harvey.
Harvey and his friends want to make Wilson governor of New Jersey, but in Democratic politics, nothing is free. Harvey and his friends want something in return.
Mr. Wilson, we are a conservative party. We must remain a conservative party. There are those radicals among us who would take hold of the party and draw it away from its true principles towards a dark, nefarious future. We ask only that you stand with us.
Wilson pauses,
a moment of contemplation.
Yes, I've given the matter a great deal of thought, Mr. Harvey. I have conferred with my colleagues and my conscience.
Yes, and?
I have no intention of dismantling the Democratic establishment. Not in New Jersey, not anywhere. I have no intention of leading the party in any dangerous new direction.
Harvey seems pleased.
Well, bear in mind, New Jersey is just the beginning. First, we take the governor's mansion, then perhaps the White House.
Wilson tries not to swallow too hard. He is desperate to make a presidential run, though he doesn't dare say so out loud. And Wilson knows he needs men like George Harvey standing in his corner to make it happen. So he contains his excitement and offers a humble, measured reply.
If my party deems it fit to nominate me for that privilege, I will do my duty and answer the call.
Well, in that case, Harvey offers Wilson his hand.
Congratulations, Mr. Governor.
I haven't won yet, Mr. Harvey.
Not yet, no. But leave that part to me.
George Harvey made good on his end of the bargain. He used his influence to help Wilson win the New Jersey governor's contest in 1910, a job that positioned Wilson as a strong candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination in 1912. But Wilson would not make good on his promise to keep the Democratic Party conservative. Even as a gubernatorial candidate, Wilson would come out in favor of certain progressive positions like tax reform, corporate controls, workers' compensation, and environmental conservation, declaring, "We are witnessing a renaissance of public spirit, a reawakening of sober public opinion, a revival of the power of the people." Unsurprisingly, as he moved towards progressivism, he alienated the conservative faction of his party, men like George Harvey. But the conservatives were dying out, and progressivism was catching on across the country. In the 1912 contest, Wilson's progressive ideas would prove nearly impossible to beat. By early 1912, the voting landscape of America had changed rapidly. Six Western states allowed women to vote in national elections. As suffragist Anna Shaw said, "The politicians are sure to realize that the women are winning their long fight and will climb on the bandwagon with the rest of us." In addition, 12 states had adopted election primaries to nominate national party delegates. These delegates would be obliged to vote the will of their state's people instead of participating in the usual horse trading among party elites at national conventions. And these state primaries necessitated that presidential hopefuls traveled the election circuit in a way they had never done before. With voters now choosing delegates, it was vital that candidates made a case for their party and personal platform directly to the people. In February 1912, Democratic and Republican candidates began canvassing the country for support. This new reality forced Roosevelt to declare his official intentions early. Since his speaking tour in the late summer of 1910, there had been rumors that the former president would enter the 1912 campaign, but Roosevelt hadn't confirmed or denied. On February 21, 1912, he attended a convention in Ohio. When a reporter outside the meeting hall asked the colonel about his presidential ambitions, Roosevelt's eagerness got ahead of him. "My hat is in the ring, and I am stripped to the buff." A month later, in March 1912, North Dakota held the first state primary. Three Republicans put their names on the ballot: President Taft, former President Roosevelt, and Wisconsin Senator Robert La Follette. The Democratic field was just as crowded. Governor Wilson ran against Speaker of the House Champ Clark and Congressman Oscar Underwood. Both parties ran tight campaigns with viable candidates, but the Republican race got more attention in the press, thanks in large part to Roosevelt's celebrity as a war hero, a game hunter, and a former president. Roosevelt had the public's attention, but not their votes. He fared badly in North Dakota and took flak for breaking his previous promise not to seek a third term. Roosevelt insisted that he had not broken the promise. This term would not be a consecutive third term. But while the colonel split hairs, the Republican voters cast their ballots for La Follette. The primaries continued through the end of May. All of the candidates crisscrossed the country, garnering delegates and vying for the top spot. All of the candidates save one. President Taft remained in Washington, D.C., playing a different game. He sought pledges of support from delegates in states that did not hold primaries. The sitting president knew he had been weakened by firing Pinchot 2 years ago, but he had no intention of giving up. Taft wrote to a friend, "I believe that I represent a great cause and that I am the only one who can fight it, and I must fight it and do the best I can." But maybe his best was not enough. While Taft fought for delegates privately, he lost badly in the Republican primaries. He even lost his home state of Ohio. Meanwhile, in the Democratic primaries, Wilson's progressivism was getting the job done. He declared, "The men who understand the life of the country are the men who are on the make, and not the men who are made, because the men who are on the make are in contact with the actual conditions of struggle." The former academic argued for stringent factory safety guidelines, unions, and government regulation of corporations. Wilson saw business as too strong, too potent a force in American life to not be regulated. He said, "Government must regulate business, because business is the foundation of every other relationship, particularly of the political relationship." Wilson inspired the voters and received financial backing from his Princeton connections to run a nationwide campaign. However, he didn't go into the Democratic convention with a majority of delegates. So to win his party's nomination, Wilson would need to catch a break. The same was true on the Republican side of the equation for Roosevelt. But unlike Wilson, the colonel would not be so lucky. On June 17, 1912, Roosevelt arrived in Chicago one day before the opening of the Republican National Convention. He was greeted by supporters, fans, and reporters. One bold journalist asked, "Are you ready to stand up to the rigors of what lay ahead?" Roosevelt replied in the affirmative, "I'm feeling like a bull moose." And once that was printed, the colonel earned himself yet another nickname, the Bull Moose. Later that evening, Roosevelt gave a rousing speech to his supporters. He claimed that Taft and the National Republican Committee were trying to steal the nomination from him. "We are fighting for honesty against naked robbery, and where robbery is concerned, that all-important question is not the identity of the man robbed, but the crime itself." The robbery Roosevelt was referring to was a number of disputed delegates coming to the convention the next day. Due to close vote counts in several primaries, the Republican National Committee had instructed 235 disputed delegates to vote for Taft. Roosevelt argued that half of those delegates should be allowed to vote for him. If the convention president allowed these Taft-pledged delegates to be seated, Roosevelt would lose the nomination. He would not have the votes to win, and he knew it. On June 18, 1912, the Republican National Convention opened. Roosevelt's supporters immediately sought to block 72 of Taft's delegates, but the convention chair, ardent Taft supporter Elihu Root, denied the request. Root's decision gave Taft a massive advantage in the delegate count and control of the convention. A few days later, on June 22nd, Roosevelt sent a statement to the convention, reading, "The convention has now declined to purge the roll of the fraudulent delegates. This action makes the convention no longer a Republican convention. Therefore, I hope the men elected as Roosevelt delegates will now decline to vote." When the words were read aloud, the convention hall erupted. Shouting matches and fistfights broke out between Roosevelt and Taft delegates. In the end, Roosevelt's delegates followed orders. That evening, 344 pro-Roosevelt delegates refused to vote for Taft, declaring themselves present but not voting. It was a symbolic but failed protest. Taft received the Republican Party nomination anyway. In the wake of the convention, Roosevelt had a decision to make. Should he accept Taft's nomination, no matter how fraudulent he considered it? Or should he bolt from the Republican Party in protest? Roosevelt chose the latter. His supporters gathered at Orchestra Hall, a few blocks from the Republican convention site. California Governor Hiram Johnson opened the last-minute meeting saying, "We came here to carry out the mandate of the people to nominate Theodore Roosevelt. We, the delegates, free and untrammeled, have come here to nominate him tonight." In this meeting, they nominated Roosevelt as the presidential candidate of a new party, the Progressive Party. The former Republican president, hailed now as the Bull Moose, accepted his new party's nomination in person, saying, "If you wish me to make the fight, I will make it." On June 25th, the Democratic National Convention opened in Baltimore, Maryland. Woodrow Wilson hoped to capitalize on the split in the Republican Party, but so did conservative Democrats. With their opponents' base divided, a Democratic win in the election was almost guaranteed. Many delegates sought to nominate a safe, well-known candidate rather than take a chance on a progressive newcomer like Wilson. On the first ballot, the delegates seemed to follow that plan. Champ Clark, a milquetoast Southern conservative, received 440 votes. Wilson only got 324, but no man had reached enough to win. The balloting continued for days with little change in the outcomes. Then a powerful Democrat put his finger on the scale. William Jennings Bryan, three-time Democratic nominee for president, threw his weight behind Wilson. Brian accused Champ Clark of relying too much on party machinery like Tammany Hall in New York. Brian declared that he would not support any man who accepted the high honor of the presidential nominee at the hands of Tammany Hall. Wilson's campaign manager sprung into action and seized the opportunity Brian gave them. Behind closed doors, they traded favors and promises until most states fell in line behind Wilson. On July 2nd, after 46 rounds of balloting, Woodrow Wilson received his party's nomination. Most Democrats backed Wilson with enthusiasm. One reporter wrote, "Intellectually, Woodrow Wilson is the best-equipped candidate the Democrats have put forward since Thomas Jefferson." One person who was not enthusiastic with Wilson's nomination was Theodore Roosevelt. He had hoped the Democrats would put forward a conservative candidate like Champ Clark, making Teddy the only ideological progressive in the field. But with Wilson's nomination, Roosevelt's prospects looked grim. The progressives who had defected with Roosevelt had a problem. The election of 1912 was only 4 months away, and they had a lot of catching up to do. To give the Bull Moose a fighting chance, they needed to organize their new party and set a campaign in motion. Financier George Perkins put up the money, and Roosevelt's allies organized a convention and campaign strategy. They knew they could beat Taft, but struggled to develop a plan that would garner the necessary 266 electoral votes required to win. Still, Roosevelt was determined to move forward, saying, "I hoisted the flag and will win or fail under it." On August 5, 1912, the official National Progressive Party convention opened in Chicago. In reference to Roosevelt's previous comment, the press immediately dubbed the party the Bull Moose Party. Roosevelt took the stage in person to outline his party's platform. He gave a two-hour speech arguing for prohibition of child labor, greater corporate regulations, an eight-hour workday, a social insurance system, and many other social justice causes. Roosevelt declared, "Surely there was never a fight better worth making than the one in which we are engaged." His Bull Moose platform also endorsed women's suffrage. It stated that no people can justly claim to be a true democracy which denies political rights on account of sex. But for all its commitment to social justice issues, the Bull Moose platform stayed ominously quiet on racial justice issues. Black delegates, if they were allowed to be seated at all, noticed this immediately. But party leaders would not hear their calls to include a line on racial equality in the platform. On the third day of the convention, Roosevelt was officially nominated as the presidential candidate of the National Progressive Party. Jane Addams, well-known social rights activist, seconded the nomination. She praised the new party, stating that it had become the American exponent of a worldwide movement towards juster social conditions. "Mr. Roosevelt has caught the significance of the modern movement." And with Roosevelt's nomination, the 1912 presidential race began in earnest, with the sitting president, a former president, and a political newcomer in the ring. Within weeks, two of the candidates would rise to the forefront, making the three-way race a head-to-head contest. If you're a careful Wicked Game listener, you know in the credits, I mentioned my friend Professor Greg Jackson and his podcast, History That Doesn't Suck. It's a great show. But one way it can doesn't suck even more is when you listen to it without ads. You can listen to all episodes of American Election's Wicked Game, all episodes of History That Doesn't Suck, and all episodes of many more great history podcasts without interruption by subscribing at intohistory.com. History That Doesn't Suck is a deeply researched chronological survey of American history from a trained academic who also knows how to tell a story. Plus, in addition to ad-free listening to one of the best American history podcasts out there, you get scores of bonus episodes at intohistory.com. Subscribe now at intohistory.com.
How do you solve a crime in reverse when you believe that someone was murdered but have no clue who the victim was?
We have to do our job. And we have to find out, who did they kill? If it's possible, how are we going to do that?
I'm Jake Halpern, and this is Deep Cover, The Nameless Man. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Roosevelt entered his third presidential race with vigor. In 1900, as the vice presidential candidate, he had played second fiddle to William McKinley. In 1904, he had followed the precedent that sitting presidents don't campaign for themselves. In 1908, he had been sidelined by a promise he himself made. In 1912, though, Roosevelt finally had a chance to take the spotlight. A family member remarked that he looked younger by 10 years than when I had last seen him, in such wonderful spirits that he behaved like a boy. But the Bull Moose did not have a young boy's judgment. He knew that Wilson made a strong competitor. Roosevelt told a confidant that Wilson was an able man who would make a creditable president. Wilson and Roosevelt soon realized that they were each other's competition. Each man left facing Taft almost entirely out of their campaign strategies. During one of Roosevelt's campaign speeches, an audience member shouted, "Tell us about Taft." Roosevelt confidently quipped, "I never discuss dead issues." But Roosevelt didn't ignore Taft entirely. He went on the attack, calling Taft a fathead and likening his intellect to that of a guinea pig. In the Democratic camp, Wilson knew that he could not win a personality contest with the Bull Moose. Instead, he planned to go after Roosevelt another way. The former professor told his daughter, "Are people interested in personalities rather than in principles? If that is true, they will not vote for me." But Wilson's policies did attract voters, as they had in New Jersey 2 years earlier. On Labor Day, the Democratic candidate introduced his platform, which he called the New Freedom. Wilson advocated for social reforms like prohibiting child labor and women's suffrage, but he thought those issues belonged to the states. As a Democrat with Southern roots, Wilson believed in the power of state governments and local control. The Democratic platform resonated with voters, but Roosevelt had an answer for them. He branded Wilson as an outdated, heartless academic who wanted a limited government incapable of true progressive reform. But Wilson had learned to fight fire with fire. He declared, "Because we won't take the dictum of a leader who thinks he knows exactly what ought to be done by everybody. We are accused of wishing to minimize the powers of the government of the United States. I'm not afraid of the utmost exercise of the powers of the government, but law in our day must come to the assistance of the individual." By September, Wilson began to pull ahead in newspaper polls across the country, so Bull Moose Party leaders looked for another way to weaken their Democratic opponent. Wilson had a close friendship with a woman named Mary Hulbert Peck. He wrote to Peck often, signing his letters with infinite tenderness. Rumors had circulated that Wilson's friendship with Peck had once been a love affair. A scandalmonger claimed to have copies of several letters between Wilson and Peck, which would prove the rumors to be true. He offered to sell the letters to Roosevelt's campaign. But the Bull Moose candidate knew these letters wouldn't slow Wilson's momentum, and so refused to use them. Those letters would be entirely unconvincing. Nothing, no evidence could ever make the American people believe that a man like Woodrow Wilson, cast so perfectly as the apothecary's clerk, could ever play Romeo. The two frontrunners continued to spar on ideological grounds, Roosevelt touting his new nationalism and Wilson campaigning for the New Freedom agenda. Both championed labor reform and workers' compensation, especially in light of recent factory disasters like the 1911 Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. But Roosevelt came out more strongly for women's suffrage. He argued, "The Progressive Party is the one party which since the Civil War has dealt with real issues, and these real issues affect women precisely as much as men." Wilson continued to insist that suffrage should be handled at the state level. Behind these headlines of a hard-fought Wilson-Roosevelt match, Taft ran a half-hearted campaign, even as another third-party candidate vied for voters' attention. Third-time Socialist Party candidate Eugene Debs ran a smart campaign that built up his party's strength, but the tight race between Wilson and Roosevelt siphoned away most of the public's interest from the Republican and Socialist campaigns. Frustrated conservative Republicans were angry at Roosevelt. One wrote, "We can't elect Taft, and we must do anything to elect Wilson so as to defeat Roosevelt." Democrats recognized this shift, and one deftly surmised, "It looks as if nothing but an accident can prevent Wilson's election, not because the country wants him especially, but because of Roosevelt's madness in splitting the GOP. For many voters, the election became an issue of defeating the Bull Moose rather than electing Wilson. So in early October, one man put a plan in motion to defeat Roosevelt on his own. It's October 14th, 1912, in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Crowds line the street outside the Gilpatrick Hotel, where Roosevelt has just finished a banquet. A nervous-looking man stands apart from the crowd. John Schrank is an outsider, a quiet man, but a disturbed one, too. No one notices the odd bulk in his coat pocket as they walk past him. Schrank is muttering to himself, "It has to be done. It must be tonight."
People give Shrank odd glances, but they ignore him, and he them. Still muttering, "No turning back now. McKinley says I must do it." Deceased President William McKinley appeared in Shrank's dreams a few weeks ago. In the vision, McKinley told Shrank to kill Theodore Roosevelt. For months, Shrank has been angry that Roosevelt is seeking a third term. In the dream, McKinley validated Shrank's anger and demanded that Shrank put a stop to Roosevelt's ambition. Shrank believes this delusion is real, and so he set into motion a plan to kill Roosevelt. That plan has brought Shrank to Gilpatrick Hotel tonight. The disturbed but determined man watches as Roosevelt exits the hotel and gets into his open touring car. Shrank grips his .38 Colt revolver and whispers to himself, "There he is, the bastard. Now's your moment, John. Now's the moment." As the car slowly moves forward, Roosevelt stands and waves to his supporters. Shrank pushes through the crowd and takes a few steps forward. In the midst of the chaos, Shrank can see his bullet hit its mark. He watches as Roosevelt slumps back on the car seat, a bloodstain blooming on his shirt front. And then, one of Roosevelt's bodyguards tackles Shrank to the ground. Shrank writhes in pain as the man rips the gun out of his hand. Then the angry bodyguard gets his hands around Shrank's throat. A crowd of sightseers cheer on the strangling. But Roosevelt's booming voice brings the violence to an end.
"Stop! Stop! Bring him to me!"
Bodyguard drags Shrank over to the car. The wounded Roosevelt stares him down. "What did you do it for?" Shrank doesn't answer. He refuses to tell Roosevelt about his vision of President McKinley. He refuses to say anything at all. He stares ahead blankly and holds his tongue.
What's the use? Turn him over to the police.
Within minutes, Shrank was taken into custody. Roosevelt went on to a scheduled speaking engagement. When he arrived at the venue, Roosevelt pulled out his speech and glasses from a suit pocket. Only then did he see the dent in his steel spectacles case and the bullet hole through all 100 sheets of thick parchment. Roosevelt realized just how narrowly he had escaped, but he didn't go straight to the hospital. He made his 90-minute speech first. Later that day, doctors discovered the bullet lodged in Roosevelt's pleura around the lungs. Doctors left the bullet and ordered Roosevelt to rest in absolute quiet for several days. After the attempted assassination, Bull Moose Party campaign staffers canceled dozens of events while Roosevelt recuperated. Sympathy for Roosevelt was widespread. When Wilson heard about the shooting, he canceled several of his speaking engagements and campaign events. Wilson's gesture to suspend his campaign was at once generous and shrewd. He laughingly told his daughter, "Teddy will have apoplexy when he hears of this." Because Wilson knew that stopping the campaign at this crucial juncture would allow him to maintain his lead while Roosevelt had no way to catch up. Though the attempted assassination of Roosevelt dominated the news cycle for a time, as Roosevelt recovered, the press moved on to other stories. On October 30th, the Bull Moose gave one last campaign speech at Madison Square Garden, but Shrank had taken the wind out of his campaign sails. On November 5th, 1912, Woodrow Wilson won the election. Though he received only 42% of the popular vote, Wilson took 40 states and 435 electoral votes. His victory over Roosevelt and Taft showed that the academic politician was able to unite the disparate elements of his party in each region of the country. Roosevelt garnered 27% of the popular vote and won electoral votes in 6 states. After the election, he told a friend, "We have fought the good fight, and we have nothing to regret." A month later, President-elect Wilson gave a speech, acknowledging his past, present, and future. As a native Southerner who had become the governor of a northern state and now president of the United States, Wilson hoped to be an instrument in drawing together the hearts of all men in the United States in the service of a nation that has neither region nor section, nor north nor south. But during Wilson's administration, international problems threatened to overshadow his progressive agenda. During his first term, President Wilson would struggle to ward off these growing foreign threats and the menacing political opponents who wanted him out of the White House. As he juggled international crises and domestic foes, he would also face off against the growing women's rights movement, disenfranchised black voters in the South, and his own personal demons. This is episode 32 of American Elections Wicked Game, 1912, The Bull Moose. On the next episode, the election of 1916,
President Wilson faces off against international threats, domestic strife, and a Republican Party hell-bent on reclaiming the White House. Their candidate, Charles Evans Hughes, is the only Supreme Court justice in American history to resign his seat to run for president. Icebergs, jagged rocks and rocky straits, mutinies, misfortune, and broadside battles. There are more tales of the sea than survivors to tell them. But the podcast Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs is doing a good job, and you can listen to all episodes of that podcast, plus many others, including American Election's Wicked Game, without interruption by subscribing at intohistory.com. Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs is one of my favorites from last year, a podcast about the greatest mishaps, misfortune, and misadventures of the sea. You'll hear stories of corruption, greed, bad intentions, and just plain horrible decision-making that resulted in some of the worst maritime disasters from all over the world. And some of these are more recent than you think. All episodes are ad-free, including bonus content and more, at intohistory.com. Subscribe now at intohistory.com. This episode contains reenactments and dramatized details. And while in most cases we can't know exactly what was said, all our dramatizations are based on historical research. American Election's Wicked Game is an Airship production, hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham. Sound design by Derek Behrens. Music by Lindsey Graham. Co-executive produced by Stephen Walters in association with Ritual Productions. Written and researched by C.L. Salazar and Stephen Walters. Fact-checking by Greg Jackson from the podcast History That Doesn't Suck.